Hey, it's me, your heart. Mind if I pick the next song? Listen, even though we're eating better, people who've had one heart attack are at higher risk of another. But Repatha Evolocumab plus a statin lowers LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, and our heart attack risk. So let's talk to our doctor about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. View the important safety information in our banner. Listen to your heart. Ask your doctor about Repatha.
Life gets messy. Spills, stains, and kid chaos. But with Anabe, cleaning up is easy. Our sofas are fully machine washable, inside and out, so you never have to stress about messes again. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Get early access to Black Friday pricing right now. Sofas start at just $699. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Ah, greetings from my bath, festive friends. The holidays are overwhelming, but I'm tackling this season with PayPal and making the most of my money. Getting 5% cash back when I pay in four. No fees, no interest. I used it to get this portable spa with jets. Now the bubbles can cling to my sculpted but pruny body. Make the most of your money this holiday with PayPal. Save the offer in the app.
Ends 12/31. See paypal.com/promo terms. Points can be redeemed for cash and more. Pay in four, subject to terms and approval. PayPal Inc. and MLS 910457.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Introducing Anabe Sofas, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices. Every Anabe sofa is modular, allowing you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabe is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slide right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink-in feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today. Sofas start at just $699 with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get early access to Black Friday now. The biggest sale of the year can save you up to 60% off, plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
You're listening to continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You may be seated.
All right. Good afternoon. All right. Kind of want to go over, I guess, the plan for the afternoon. It's still your intention to rest?
Yes, Your Honor. We have just the exhibits ready to be tendered to the clerk that have been already moved and admitted by Your Honor during the pendency of our case. They've all got the stamps and stuff on them now. Right. Once we do that, we're resting.
Okay. Is the defense calling any witnesses after motions?
Yes, Your Honor. In the event that there was an adverse ruling, I would intend to call Deputy Blythe as the sole defense witness for today. And then I would ask for additional time after that to confer with counsel about any additional witnesses that we may call, depending on how that shakes out and how this motion proceeds.
Okay. All right. So what I've done before is I've let the plaintiff rest outside the presence of the jury. We've done the motion so the jury's not up and down, and then I will let you officially rest in front of the jury, and then I'll ask you to call your first witness.
Yes,
Does that make sense to everybody?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. You have a... Yes, Ms.
Barton. It's a motion about the first witness before we get to that witness.
All right, but after you rest.
Yes.
Okay, right, okay. All right, very well. All right, you have exhibits you'd like to tender?
Yes, Your Honor, I have, and I'll just go through them in Ms. Douglas's presence. We have 3A, 3C, Those were all during the testimony of Corporal Blythe. Then we have 90A, 90B, which were admitted during the testimony of Miss Julie Zwerner. And we have 90C, which was admitted during the testimony of Hannah Zwerner. And we have 108, which was admitted, the sections of 108 that were admitted during the testimony of Abigail Zwerner. And then on a flash drive, Your Honor, we have Exhibit 4, 110A, 110B, 9A, and 90D.
Okay. Madam Clerk, does that match up? All right, very well. And any objection besides everything already noted?
No. Okay. Objections preserved on as argued.
Correct.
And 22 was previously admitted and provided to the clerk.
Okay. All right, with admission to those objections preserved, do you have a motion?
Yes, Your Honor, we rest now.
All right.
We do wish, and it's to Your Honor's preference, we wish to raise that motion for reconsideration on Your Honor's ruling as it relates to the existence of a special relationship duty owed by Defendant Ebony Parker to Miss Abigail Zwerner as part of a class of individuals, if we may be heard on that at this time.
All right. I mean, is it anything outside the briefs that you've already filed? It is?
It is, Your Honor.
All right. All right, so you have rested, or no, you do you want to make that motion before you rest, I guess?
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
Judge, can I say, the defense would object to this argument that occurred, just because I think I would rest on the prior arguments that I raised from the defense, the motion to limit their theory of prosecution. There are some overlapping arguments here. I would just contend that this is not an appropriate time to attempt to revive a prior theory, alternative legal theory. This court has already heard it and considered a motion for summary judgment and dismissed with prejudice.
All right. I'll hear the objection at this time.
Yes, Your Honor.
The motion at this time.
Your Honor, ultimately, when a claim is pled as a duty for the special relationship was pled in this action, which was count three, it remains before the court, and it is the province of the court to reconsider or reevaluate its rulings at any point in time before the case is dismissed. And specifically, the courts have observed in circumstances involving motions for reconsideration, if there's been a ruling as it relates to a motion for summary judgment, which is a mixed question of law and fact. In other words, facts were provided to the court at that time, which may not have been wholesome or complete as it relates to what has now been preserved or presented at trial. It is appropriate to renew the motion, and then ultimately Your Honor will rule on it as Your Honor deems appropriate and fit. So the legal position here, Judge, is grounded in the court's decision, the Virginia Supreme Court's decision in Burns v. Gagnon, which was, as we've cited before, 283 Virginia 657. And specifically, it is a special relationship that was first recognized by the Virginia Supreme Court in the Burdett case. The Burdett case involved a case involving a sheriff's deputy who came across an individual on the side of the road. And the observation of the court in that case, and this is a quote from the Burns case, which is quoting the Burdett case, which says, "When a negligence claim is made against a public official, a distinction must be drawn between the official's public duty owed to the citizenry at large and the official's special duty owed to a specific identifiable person or class of persons." And then the court goes on to say in Burns, not quoting Burdett, "Only a violation of the latter will give rise to liability," quoting Burdett again, "because it is not in society's best interest to subject public officials to potential liability for every action undertaken." He goes on to say that in determining whether a special relationship exists under the present facts, that is the facts in Burns, it observed that here it is important to consider whether Burns reasonably could have foreseen that he would be expected to take affirmative action to protect, in that case, Gagnon from harm. What we have here, Your Honor, is a duty that reflects exactly that, in our view, which is that the assistant principal, based upon the documentation that's been submitted, that's Exhibit 22, Exhibit 109, the testimony of Farish and the testimony of our expert, as well as the others, who all were under the understanding of a protocol that the assistant principal had a special relationship as it relates to each of them to handle circumstances specifically as it relates to the possession of a firearm, but certainly when there's a foreseeable risk of a firearm on campus. And under those circumstances, the court has recognized that while Ebony Parker did not owe a duty to the public or the citizenry at large, there was an identifiable class of persons at Rich Neck Elementary School who were under or subject to reasonably foreseeable harm to which she did owe a duty. That is a special relationship separate and apart from the assumed duty of care that we've talked about previously. And as a result of that relationship, Your Honor, we believe that the evidence sufficiently demonstrated A, that it existed, that is, there is a distinct special relationship between her and individuals, which Ms. Zwirner is a class member of, as a teacher, as a staff member of that school at the time, and then also that there was reasonable foreseeability in this circumstance in light of the fact that there were repeated multiple reports that reached Ms. Ebony Parker, Dr. Ebony Parker, excuse me, as it relates to the firearm on campus and in the possession of JT. And I bring that point out because one of the foreseeability analysis in this case and other cases is, do we know who might have something that's dangerous? And it was Nina Farish's testimony that specifically quoted Dr. Parker in terms of her interview that identified it. A, Dr. Parker was aware of the gun. B, Dr. Parker was aware that JT was reported to have the gun. And C, through the testimony of both Nina Farish and Mr. Rawls, as late as 1:40 p.m. that afternoon, 2 hours roughly after her first notification of a firearm, there was still understanding that there was a firearm present on the campus in light of the fact that they said, let's wait and see once mom gets here. It wasn't, we don't need to, there's no firearm. It was, let's wait and see. And so in light of those circumstances, Your Honor, we believe that it is appropriate to instruct the jury when we get to that point as it relates to a special relationship first recognized in Burdett, affirmed in Burns, and then demonstrated through the evidence today.
Thank you. The court's going to deny your motion to reconsider and relies on its opinion previously published in this case on that issue. All right. Now, having made that decision, any other motions?
Yes, there's a motion from the defense judge.
Well, now you're resting, right?
Yes, Judge.
Okay. Plaintiff now rests. All right. Mr. Hogan.
May it please the court. Your Honor, for convenience, I've shared some case law with the opposing counsel. I'm sure he's familiar with it. If I may pass this up to the court as well. I'm sure Your Honor is very well familiar with this. We have litigated this many times, these issues, but I think it will still benefit the court. Thank you. And Your Honor, let me note as a threshold matter, there will be two components to this motion. The first, I intend to proceed on an ordinary motion to strike based on the elements and whether or not the plaintiff has established a prima facie showing necessary to survive a motion to strike. In addition, after this, my colleague, Mr. Alex Bennett, will approach the podium and make a renewed motion to dismiss based on workers' compensation. I'd ask the court to consider that as well.
Not any argument on that.
I understand, Judge.
You can renew it. Now, no, you need another associate to do it, but that'll be a real quick decision.
I understand, Judge.
All right.
Just want to make the court aware of that.
All right.
With respect for the motion to strike, Judge, the standard's well established. Even the purpose of the motion to strike, it is proper to grant one where it is conclusively apparent that the plaintiff has proven no cause of action. The court has to require and accept as true all the evidence favorable to the plaintiff and grant the plaintiff any reasonable inferences that may be drawn from the evidence. This is a very favorable standard. We can view the evidence in the light most favorable to my opponent. Nevertheless, Judge, given the binding and unequivocally clear Virginia case law when it comes to the assumption of a duty in the specific context of third-party intentional or criminal harm, the steep threshold evidentiary showing that is required to trigger that obligation, combined with the steep evidentiary showing that is required to establish gross negligence, I would contend that they have failed to make a prima facie showing. To give a quick overview, in this case, plaintiffs needs to establish that, number one, Dr. Parker voluntarily and expressly assumed a duty to exercise reasonable care to protect Abigail Zwirner from third-party criminal harm. I understand my opponent will dispute that this is criminal harm. The same doctrine under the assumed duty applies equally to intentional harm, so it is immaterial for purposes of this hearing, I'll just reference it to as third-party harm. That's number one. Number two, they need to establish that Dr. Parker breached that duty under the relevant standard of care to a degree amounting to gross negligence. In addition, they need to establish that she was that gross negligence was proximate cause of the alleged injuries. And then in addition, they need to establish the three potential prongs under the restatement second of torts, as recognized in Burns versus Gannon. And under section 324A, there are three potential avenues for liability there. In conjunction with the elements I've just identified, they need to establish either that Dr. Parker, her gross negligence increased the risk of harm to Ms. Warner, or Dr. Parker undertook to perform a duty owed by another person to the plaintiff, or yet alternatively, number three, that Ms. Warner suffered harm because of her or a third person's reliance upon Dr. Ebony Parker's alleged undertaking. And I'll talk about reliance and emphasize it in the course of this argument, Judge, because case law has shed light on what is required to establish reliance. So focusing first, Judge, on the duty element, first and foremost, two pieces to this, Judge. It's gotta be express, and then number two, there's authority establishing that a promise alone is insufficient as a matter of law. It needs to be combined with an affirmative act in furtherance of actual performance of the undertaking. Regarding the first point, Judge, the Supreme Court of Virginia has held unequivocally that an assumed duty to protect another from third-party harm cannot arise unless there is an express undertaking. An express undertaking, that means an express communication of a, quote, specifically described undertaking to take on a legal duty to exercise reasonable care to protect another from third-party harm. It has to be clear, unambiguous, it has to be talking, saying something. The case law is established that an implied undertaking is insufficient. And the case law has also established, it has defined an undertaking, in general, it is referred to, it equates to a promise or agreement. So what this means is that in the context of third-party criminal harm, in order to be on the hook for that, they need to establish that there is an express communication of a specifically described undertaking that's essentially a promise or agreement that Dr. Parker said to the plaintiff or to another person in the course of the day on January 6, 2023, a promise or agreement specifically to protect the plaintiff from the criminal harm or intentional harm that befell her. And the record is devoid of that, Judge. We've heard no testimony whatsoever that Dr. Parker made any express promise to anyone. At most, it has always been a reliance on implicit or implied tacit assurances. In fact, that was expressly pleaded in the plaintiff's complaint. In paragraphs 41 and 42 of the complaint, they alleged specifically that Dr. Parker, quote, expressly assumed a duty to protect Abby Zwerner by making certain assurances that were, in essence, assurances that JT was unarmed and then failed to fulfill those assurances by taking additional steps to ensure that they were true. That was their allegation. But we haven't heard anything about any express promise or agreement to say, I am going to protect you, Abby Zwerner. At most, it has been implied. And there's good reason for these principles, Judge. The reason is because, in general, third-party criminal harm, those acts are unforeseeable. Generally, as a matter of law, they are unforeseeable because you cannot control the volition of other individual actors. That is all the more so in this case, Judge, where you've heard evidence from the plaintiff's own witnesses repeatedly acknowledging that no one would have expected a six-year-old to bring a firearm from their home into an elementary school and shoot a teacher. This is as unforeseeable as it gets, Judge. And the rationale for why these rules exist for the express undertaking requirement are particularly acute in this case. It has got to be express. It cannot be left to conjecture or implication. It has got to be verbal from Dr. Parker, and that is not here in this case. There's no evidence whatsoever of that. The court has repeatedly reinforced this principle. First, it was articulated in Terry. Terry versus Irish Fleet, which the court is familiar with. There's a copy for the court's reference. But there, that's when they first came out, and they came. The Supreme Court was at a fork in the road. They had to decide, look, we understand that for ordinary negligence cases, you can raise your hand and take on a legal duty that doesn't otherwise exist under the law through your conduct alone, through your voluntary conduct. And they gave examples. They cited the Nold case and the Pullman case. These are all cases dealing with a motorist who's traveling down the road. They see a pedestrian on the sidewalk. They signal over. They have no obligation under the law to signal to the pedestrian that it is safe to proceed. Yet by doing that, they have assumed a duty, or arguably have assumed a duty, to exercise this duty safely. You can't wave someone across the street without exercising reasonable care. And in Nold, they said, yes, that can happen. And whether or not that you have undertaken a duty to protect someone based on those gestures or implied conduct depends on objective reasonableness. But they, in Terry, the question was whether or not does that same general principle extend to the third-party harm context, third-party criminal harm, third-party intentional harm context. And there they said unequivocally, no. The Supreme Court put its foot down and drew the line there. And the reason they said that, they provided a rationale. It was not arbitrary. They said that if we did not require an express undertaking, to leave this to implication would be too ambiguous. It doesn't define the scope of the responsibility. It doesn't define how long someone undertakes this duty. It's too ill-defined for someone to be subject to liability for these unforeseeable third-party acts. And that's what's happening in this case, Judge. You've heard from their own witnesses. No one could have foreseen that the 6-year-old child would have come to school and brought this weapon and perpetrated this act. It is unprecedented. I acknowledge, Judge, that in the case law under AH versus Church of God in Christ, there is language. Church of God in Christ came in 2019 after Terry, 1 year after Terry, and it acknowledged Terry's holding, but it said, look, conduct that is tantamount to an express communication of a specifically described undertaking may be sufficient to trigger an assumed duty to protect another from third-party harm. And they cited specifically to the portion of the Terry cases cited the Nold cases. I would emphasize, Judge, that did not alter the standard. Terry is the standard. Terry has always been the law. It is the precedent, and it was unequivocal that an express undertaking is required, an express promise or agreement. Implied conduct alone is insufficient. And the Court of Appeals has repeatedly affirmed that principle, recently in Good versus Huguenot Springs. That was 2024 VA App Lexus 441. That is a 2024 case, Judge. And that one, they said, noting that under Terry, a duty to protect another person from third-party criminal harm can, quote, arise only after an express undertaking, meaning an, quote, express promise. It has to be explicit. And when they applied it to the facts of that case, it's very similar. It's informative to what happened here. In that case, there was a landowner who owned property. He allowed and authorized someone to come onto the land for recreational purposes. He did not inform that party that there are tenants that occupy the premises, and might become upset. Nevertheless, his guest went onto the property, and unbeknownst to him, the tenants came out. Of course, they became upset, and an assault occurred. He turns around and sues the landowners. He argued that by authorizing them to enter the land, he tacitly assured, without saying it, he tacitly assured that it was safe to do so. And the Court of Appeals rejected that. They said, Terry is the law. You cannot have tacit assurances when it comes to third-party criminal or intentional conduct. It has got to be expressed. It has got to be explicit. And that's as recent as 2024, Judge. This is binding established precedent. Independent of that, Judge, there's another problem with the duty element, and that has to do with the fact that under Kellerman versus McDonough, which I did not provide that in the materials here, Judge, but I'm sure the court is familiar with it. It appears on our briefs. In the concurrence by Justice Kinzer, he notes that how they use the term undertaking under Virginia law is somewhat ambiguous. Some hold that it's a promise or agreement. Some say that it requires an affirmative act in furtherance. Some jurisdictions apply an amalgam. Here, he was emphasizing that, look, an express promise or agreement alone is insufficient. even if someone promises another that I'm going to protect you, you cannot be liable in tort for that. And part of that has to do with the fact that in Virginia, it is well established that nonfeasance, basically liability for not acting, does not impose tort liability. You cannot be on the hook for tort liability generally based on contract. Contract and tort, church and state, generally separate and independent. And that's what happens when all you have is a promise or agreement to do something and there's no follow through or performance, then that you're seeking to impose tort liability for what amounts to basically a contract. And in Kellerman, they noted that even though the assumed duty doctrine seeks to kind of reconcile these principles, at the end of the day, what is required to trigger tort liability, there must be an affirmative act in furtherance of the promise. And that's why in Kellerman, that was the case where there were parents who dropped off children at another parent's house, asked them, it's fine if they do a sleepover, but do not take my daughter on a trip. Do not allow my daughter to be driven by inexperienced male drivers. And they promised. In response, in that case, they replied, I promise we'll take care of her, or words to that effect. That is the language that appears in the opinion. And in addition, the mom not only promised that, but she then allowed the children to go to a mall and be transported by an inexperienced male driver, which resulted in tragedy. There was a collision. There was a combination not only of a promise or agreement, but an affirmative act in furtherance, because the mother assisted in transporting the children, authorizing their transport by the individual that was prohibited by the other parents. And in Kellerman, they said, look, this is the law. You need an affirmative act in furtherance, not a bare promise alone. How does that relate to this case, Judge? In our case, the plaintiffs have repeatedly asserted, and their witnesses have claimed, that Dr. Parker was indifferent. They argue that people were banging on the door saying, there's a firearm here, and she's not acting. And several witnesses have testified that she did not look up or respond at all. If that is their evidence, there cannot be an express undertaking to protect Abby Zwerner. There cannot be. The absence of action is the complete opposite of what this doctrine is all about. It's about making promises and then failing to fulfill them, or making promises, acting on them, and then ceasing your voluntary undertaking that results in harm. And we have none of those things here, Judge. At best, the critical moments you've heard counsel in opening statement and during the evidence in this case emphasize that there are repeated reports, four reports. Those are the critical moments where the jury needs to consider the evidence and see what evidence was exchanged at that time. And what we've heard is that there's no one who's come into court and said, Dr. Parker has responded, yes, I'm going to get right on that. Yes, I will take care of this. It is all implied. It is all left to their subjective interpretations of her demeanor. You've heard Amy Kovac testify that she went into the office and Dr. Parker didn't respond when she was talking about searching the backpack. You've heard Abigail Zwerner testify that when she entered the office, Dr. Parker didn't look up. That is their contention. And if that's the case, there cannot be an expressly assumed undertaking to protect another from third-party harm. Additionally, Judge, I want to focus on, under the restatement, we have these prongs. There are three prongs for avenues for recovery here. There's reliance, there's increasing the risk of harm, and there's also assuming a duty owned by another to the plaintiff. I'll just be very quick on this, Judge. The theory dealing with liability based on assuming a duty that another person owed Abigail Zwerner, that is an apposite in this case. It has nothing to do and has no application here. Generally, that type of that doctrine applies where there's a company that by contract has agreed to render a service for another entity. So it's usually like a security service that by contract agrees, I'm going to carry out this business's safety obligations. We've got none of that here. It has no bearing here. The other component here is increasing the risk of harm. They would have to establish that in addition to an express undertaking, by promising to protect someone, it actually left Abigail Zwerner worse off. It exacerbated the risk of harm. And we don't have that in this case, Judge, because we, again, their evidence was that Dr. Parker did not act. Not acting cannot amount to an express undertaking. Not acting is their theory, and if that's their evidence, it's insufficient as a matter of law. Finally, Judge, when it comes to reliance, the restatement itself just uses the term reliance, but the case law interpreting it, AH versus Church of God in Christ and several others, Terry versus Irish Fleet, it's actually two components, at least. It has to be justifiable and detrimental. Detrimental reliance requires that by promising or agreeing to protect Abigail Zwerner, it induced her to rely on that and forego taking additional safety precautions she otherwise would have done. The record is silent on that, Judge. We've heard no evidence from Abigail Zwerner, despite the opportunity to testify to this. She never testified that if Dr. Parker had done X, Y, or Z, I would have done this, and I would have exercised reasonable measures for my own safety. We have no inducement, we have no detrimental reliance. In addition, Judge, independent of the detrimental element, it has got to be justifiable. Justifiable meaning reliance fails as a matter of law if it's not reasonable. It has to be objectively reasonable. And that's where those motorist cases come in. The Nold case, the Ring versus Pohl case, those are all about, look, if somebody knows the true facts, if somebody knows there's a threat and reports it up to somebody, and the administrator or executive says, look, you're safe, there's no need to be alarmed, but you have independently, through your own investigation, with your own eyes, seen there is an imminent threat. If that's what your theory is, that's what your evidence, it would be unreasonable as a matter of law to rely on that. There can be no reliance as a matter of law. This is well established in a variety of contexts, Virginia law, Judge. It's in fraud, it's in the assumed duty context, it appears in judicial estoppel. This is a well-established principle. It must be objectively reasonable. And where, especially where the party that's asserting reliance investigated the facts themselves and tried to identify what's going on here, what is the threat, they can't rely on somebody else. And that is what happened in the Nold case, Judge. That is what happened the Nold case, where there was a pedestrian who they could see. They were crossing the street, and they looked, and they could see that the driver or motor to determine able and accessible to the pedestrian versus the driver themselves was not in a position to see if there was a threat. And the pedestrian could see. It would be unreasonable as a matter of law to rely on somebody waving you across the street when you can see there's a truck coming down the highway. That's what it means. And so here, taking their evidence, viewed in the light most favorable to them, we dispute this, but under that standard, if they're saying there's a fire, there's a fire, there's a fire, they're watching the fire happen, there's a train crash coming, and then they're reporting to a party who's not present, who's not on scene and witnessing this firsthand, they can't then say, oh, well, we relied on this person who wasn't present. We know the true facts, we know what's going on, but we're reporting to this person who's off scene, and I'm going to rely on what they're telling me, that we're safe. That would be unreasonable as a matter of law. Finally, Judge, I just want to emphasize that independent of all of these arguments, at the end of the day, this is a gross negligence case. That is a demanding legal standard, and what it amounts to is they need to establish indifference, not inadequacy. The case law is well established that if the evidence shows that there was an exercise of at least some degree of care by Dr. Parker, this doesn't go to a jury. And this is crucial, Judge. We have heard from Amy Kovac testified, and on day two of trial, she, in essence, testified that Dr. Parker assented to a search of the backpack. that Dr. Parker directed her to search the backpack. She would dispute that, but in the transcript, it appears on page 199 of the day two trial transcript, she was asked, and so then, Ms. Kovach, did Dr. Parker respond to you or give you any direction? And she responded, she kind of nodded and acknowledged that that's what I was going to do. And Ms. Toscano asked her, you let her know that I'm going to check the backpack? And she said, yes, and she nodded her head. That is a subordinate going to an administrator, telling them I'm planning to search a backpack and looking to them for guidance. For direction was the question. And in response, Dr. Parker nodded her head. What does that mean? That means that is not indifference. That is not someone disregarding reported threats. That is acknowledging the threat, looking to her subordinate who is requesting assent and authorization to search a backpack, and she's giving it. That is an exercise of at least some degree of care. And just because there was a bad outcome or some jurors might disagree with the decision that additional steps might have been required, that demonstrates that there was an exercise of at least some degree of care. And it's not just that. There's the searching of the backpack, and there's also the directing other staff to tell Mrs. Werner, you can call the mom. You can call JT's mom. If you are uncomfortable, I'm trusting your judgment and discretion. You are someone who is on scene in the position to see whether or not this threat is imminent or not. And I'm authorizing you to act.
So if you agree that that's what the evidence is, aren't those express undertakings as well and undermining your first argument?
I would actually argue two things, Judge. I think these are all, we can argue in the alternative, and they can't have it both ways.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
So I think that's astute of you to pick up on that, Judge, and I think it makes sense. I think their evidence establishes the exercise of at least some degree of care, and alternatively, they fail to establish the assumption of a duty. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I mean, you can stand up and renew your motion on the workers' comp. I'm denying it based on what I ruled on before, so if you want to put that on the record, that's fine. I'm not listening to any argument.
Your Honor, we would just place on the record our continuing objection to the court's subject matter jurisdiction to even hear this claim based on the workers' compensation bar, Virginia Code 65.2-307.
All right, court notes your renewed objection to my previous ruling that this was a personal injury and not workers' comp. All right, I don't need you to respond to that. You can rely on everything we've already said in my written opinion. Okay.
Not comp stuff. You want to respond to the other stuff?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I
just observe for the record that I think the understanding of what is well established in the law in Virginia is in high dispute here. And in fact, at one point in time, opposing counsel told you that there is binding authority from the Court of Appeals from, I think it was the Good case, and I think cited another Court of Appeals case, both of which are unpublished, which means that you actually doesn't bind you. And so I think it's important for us to recognize that all of the rhetoric surrounding the argument about what is and what is not the law is not what guides this court, of course. It is what the law says it is. And when we talk about an instance such as this one and the framing of it from the defendant's perspective, which is that this is an act of third-party crime, or the pivot that we hear today, intentional act, the law says it cannot be. It cannot be either of those things, no matter the evidence before the court. And it cannot be those things because a six-year-old does not have the capacity for an intentional act or a criminal act. And that's been recognized in the criminal court decisions. We've cited to this in a footnote in one of our motions in limine oppositions. And in fact, it's reflected at least implicitly within the Virginia model jury instructions, which talk about the fact that anyone under the age of 7 doesn't even have the capacity to be negligent, let alone gather the mens rea, if we use the criminal term, to actually form any form of intent that is recognizable under the law. And it's important to distinguish that because Terry versus Irish Fleet and the progeny of cases in which they are now citing all stem from this presumption and assumption that it is an intentional crime committed by an adult. We're talking about sexual abuse crimes or crimes of criminal assaultive behavior, all from an adult, never a minor in those cases. And how we can distinguish that is in the Burns case, when it doesn't involve an adult, there is no discussion of that area of the law in regards to this express undertaking. It was before Terry versus Irish Fleet, but in terms of these criminal assaultive behavior contexts. I say that because it's indicative of the applicable law here, which we believe it allows an implied undertaking under 324A, although we don't think that our evidence requires an implied undertaking in order for this to survive a motion to strike and ultimately go to the jury for a decision, and largely for the observation that Your Honor just made right before the close of their argument, which is to say that during the course of this day, and I will hold their feet to the fire on this, if their position is that by nodding her head, Ms. Dr. Ebony Parker acknowledged a threat and acknowledged a threat such that there was a joint action taken by Ms. Kovac as her subordinate, that is an undertaking. That is an undertaking specific to a firearm on the campus at Richneck Elementary, beginning at 11:40 in the morning and ending at some point that afternoon when the school is out. When school's out. And why I make that point is that if we were to even look at Terry versus Irish Fleet, the citation that was read to the court as it relates to that implicit or implied criminal undertaking talks about how in that circumstance, the alleged undertaking, this is a quote, is necessarily ambiguous and there is no designated beginning or end to the undertaking. That's not true here. There is a specific undertaking. There is a gun on campus. There is a specific time frame. It is 11:40 and this child's gonna leave school at 2:30, that's when mom's coming. And repeatedly from that moment, the evidence has demonstrated that she acknowledged the threat, counsel's words, that they repeatedly failed to act, which is a choice, not nonfeasance, it's misfeasance. And why is it misfeasance? Because the protocols and the policies that have been admitted into evidence said that this is actually what you're supposed to do. You are supposed to do these things in this circumstance. And it is misfeasance not to comply with those protocols. It's not a nonfeasance circumstance. And ultimately, when we get to this issue of is this surviving a motion to strike, which is our narrow issue before the court at this moment, I would point the court to the footnote in the Terry versus Irish Fleet case, which observed that when the issue is not whether the law recognizes a duty, but rather when the defendant by his conduct, in this circumstance, her conduct, assumed a duty, the existence of that duty is a question for the fact finder. And even the Burns case observed that it was inappropriate to make a decision on that case involving an assumed duty of care before it was actually provided to the fact finder to then make a finding as it relates to an assumed duty, and then render a verdict or a decision as it relates to that finding as well. And so on the issues of an assumed duty of care, when we look at the Burns case, which cites to 324A, we believe that all three of the prongs are applicable in this circumstance. A, her failure to exercise reasonable care increases the risk of such harm. Everyone in this school was waiting on the cavalry. And the cavalry was Dr. Parker, because that's what the protocols stapled to the back of Ms. Werner's classroom told her would happen. And that's what she understood based on the questioning of Ms. Werner, even in cross-examination, was going to happen. And then this argument, as Mr. Hogan points out, which is, well, there's no it's inapplicable to talk about an undertaken duty to perform a duty by the other to the third person. My question to the court then is, why are we talking about all the things that the other teachers were supposed to do then? If you want to talk about all the things that the other teachers were supposed to do, they've practically demonstrated the assumed duty of care in that regard. And then third, the harm is suffered because of reliance of the other or the third person upon the undertaking. I'd point out to the court, this is where, you know, there's a difference between how you cook your steak well or rare, and they say it's well-established law, and I'd say their arguments are rare. And the reason I say that is they're citing to cases that are inapplicable in this context as it relates to reliance, when you're talking about fraud claims, or in the context of a case involving a pedestrian on the corner of a road and whether or not to cross the roadway in the Knoll case. It's not about reliance. It's about a question of contributory negligence in the context of crossing a roadway. And the motion that's being made in this moment is not a motion that they've met their burden on contributory negligence. The motion is that we haven't put enough evidence before the court for a reasonable fact finder with all inferences in our favor, in viewing the light of the evidence in our favor, could not reasonably conclude that the issues in the case at bar fall in our favor. And so, as it relates to the duty, I think it's well established, quote from them, and I'll move to this issue of gross negligence. On the point of gross negligence, Your Honor, and just because I think that this is an issue that will obviously turn its head again if we argue jury instructions, there's a pertinent case from the Virginia Court of Appeals, which is the Howard versus Harris case that came out in 2024, where the court essentially observed that the evidence at the trial court level was actually sufficient for a gross negligence finding. And they observed sort of this circumstance in which an officer had cuffed somebody and therefore exercised some care, but that in and of itself didn't amount to this scant care requirement or scant care language within the Elliott case, which preceded or predated this. And I point that out because it has a great recitation of circumstances in which gross negligence may still be found in circumstances if the jury were to even interpret the conduct as exercising care in the beginning. And that's a jury question of whether what Dr. Parker did was a demonstration of care in any regard. And I'd point out to the court that there's a case, Chapman versus City of Virginia Beach, it was Mr. Bright's case, he'll tell us about it later, in which the question was, and the instructions I think will be appropriate to the jury, about you can have multiple instances of simple negligence that amount together to gross negligence. And if nothing else, even our view is each act of a firearm on campus, which they claim is unforeseeable, and yet their handbook says weapons on the property, meaning they're foreseeing a weapon on the property. Each instance in which it wasn't addressed and gotten to the bottom of by Dr. Parker is evidence of gross negligence and indifference. But as Dr. Shuffelbarger testified to our expert, ultimately in culmination, it is absolutely shocking. It's absolutely shocking, the facts of this case. And she used those words, which are words that are parroted by the Supreme Court and the courts as it relates to instructions, whether the conduct shocks the conscience, but is somewhat less than reckless indifference, which is sort of how the courts quote that language. And so, for the reasons stated, Your Honor, I think we've demonstrated sufficiently at this stage for a jury to determine the finding of the assumed duty of care. The assumed duty is recognized under the law, as Your Honor's previously articulated, and that the evidence before the court is sufficient to demonstrate that there's gross negligence.
All right, thank you. All right, the issues that have been raised are issues for the fact finder, which in this case is the jury, to decide. At this time, the court finds that there is sufficient and credible evidence that the defendant assumed a duty of care, breached that care in a grossly negligent manner, and that breach was the proximate cause of the plaintiff's harm. That will be all for the jury to decide. I deny the motion to strike. All right. Yep. All right. Having said that, you said you have one witness ready, or did you need to check
that? Let me check to see if they're present. They should be here. It would be Deputy Thomas Blythe. Okay. Let me check, right?
He's here.
All right.
All right. Check.
Bring in the jury.
Your Honor, before you do that, I have a motion with regard to Blythe.
Oh, that's Blythe. Right. Okay, I apologize. You did warn me. All right, go ahead.
I thought we should do it before the jury.
Yes, sir. That's fine.
Well, Judge, Corporal Blythe.
I've received notice of this.
He's a
witness. Yesterday, he represented to the court that he wanted to call Officer Corporal Blythe for purposes of impeachment of a witness who has testified to an inconsistent prior statement. That's what he said yesterday. He did not release Blythe. He's now bringing Blythe back. He represented to the court that the purpose of this corporal testifying was to say that Amy Kovac had said something differently to him. As the court is full aware, Rule 2-613, prior oral statements, and I have seen this in a number of cases, the only way you can impeach Ms. Kovac from a prior inconsistent statement is to have presented, under 613, that statement to her, let her explain it or not, and then if there's an inconsistent statement, then you can question her credibility. That was not done. And therefore, we don't believe, if that's the purpose of Blythe, then he cannot testify because they did not follow the process or the rules. Hearsay, one, secondarily. But 613 would specifically bar it, as would the rule 403, 8.0 and 403.
All right, so is that your intent?
There's twofold intent, Judge. There are some statements that would otherwise qualify as hearsay if not for their truth. One purpose would be for impeachment, but I understand the arguments are well taken.
Thank you.
By Mr. Bright. But the evidence, the law in Virginia, you can also use third-party witnesses to impeach by contradiction. They can testify to what another person said. They can then call Ms. Kovac again in their own rebuttal. They just need an opportunity for cross-examination. That is all that the rules require. So I would push back on that. Secondarily, Judge, I think there are additional statements on those videos that show her state of mind, and it is relevant for the jury to see that, because although she makes statements, they would not be offered for the truth. They can show and demonstrate to the jury what she was thinking at the time she was investigating the events leading to the shooting. The jury needs to see this to determine how to assess the material facts in this case. It would be fundamentally unfair to deny them this opportunity. I would suggest that the court, these are like 11-second clips, 20-second clips. Can I show them to the court? We can view them, and you can make that call.
Well, I think as we talked about previously, allow him to voir dire the witness. I think I've got to hear everything that they want to try to do, and then I can rule on it question by question. So,
live in front of the jury?
No, right. We'll do that before we call the jury.
Well, procedurally, we have a problem. Can't impeach your own witness. Can't do it. And two, obviously the purpose, as he stated yesterday before he read the law, was I want to impeach her for a prior inconsistent statement. So now to come forward with a new theory, we've got to understand the context and her state of mind. The state of mind is to ask her on the stand, not to ask a videotape for Officer Blythe.
Well, I've got to see it first, and then I'll hear arguments. So I think we need to proceed in that fashion.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
I'll get you, Blythe. Judge, you want me to just direct the counsel table or the rostrum?
No, from the the middle there.
Pardon me?
No, he remains sworn in. I'll ask him that the first time. Thank Corporal Wright, you remain under oath.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Just a moment, Your Honor. Can you just retreat for minutes? Good morning again, Deputy Blythe.
Morning. Or afternoon.
Afternoon, rather. Deputy Blythe, you recall yesterday you offered testimony about your response to the Vershnek shooting on January 6, 2023, correct?
Yes.
And you recall you testified that when you arrived at the school in response to the reported shooting, you encountered some of the staff and teachers there, including Dr. Ebony Parker, as well as the reading specialist, Amy Kovac. Do you recall
yes.
that? And I believe your testimony yesterday was that in the course of your encounter with those folks, Ms. Kovacs spoke to you and told you about what happened leading to the shooting, right?
She did.
At the time you were speaking to Ms. Kovacs, were you equipped with your body-worn camera?
I was.
And did it record your conversation with Ms. Kovacs?
It did.
And would you recognize that video shown to you again?
Yes.
Brian, if you could please display Defense Exhibit 57A8 for Mr. Blythe.
He had something in his pocket. I said, keep him in your eye. And I went to pull my AP.
Awesome recording. Your Honor, can you see the recording?
I can see it. I couldn't really hear it great.
So I would just start back from the beginning, and could you please play it for the benefit of Deputy Blythe in the court, please?
He had something in his pocket. I said, keep him in your eye. And I went to pull my AP. And, just a mess, and we were just watching him. And we thought, if anything, it was a toy.
So, Judge, from an evidentiary...
Right, so hold on one second. Hold on one second. Is there any objection to that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and what is the objection? If it's the same one as before, I just want to make sure we're all on the same page.
Well, first of all, he secondarily indicated that it was for state of mind. Amy Kovacs' state of mind is not relevant for purposes of her statement. I stand on 613 in that she was not presented with the statement, and so if she wasn't able to explain her statement, it is an extrinsic evidence to impeach, which is not permitted under 613-2, and her state of mind as to what she said is not relevant for her understanding.
Right, you have a response to that?
And the other comment, when I missed it, she said, we thought, in her that statement that we just heard. We don't know who we thought and what the timing was for purposes of the we and who said what to whom. And so for multiple reasons, it's not proper. It's speculative.
All right. Do you want to argue?
Yes, Judge. First, with respect to relevance, Amy Kovacs' state of mind is relevant because we will have an expert that will testify for the defense, and it will be well established in the evidence that in assessing whether, how, and when to respond to a reported threat, an administrator needs to consider these subjective independent assessments of their subordinates. And so if Amy Kovacs has come here and told the jurors that I was banging on this administrator's door, I was telling her, this is a gun, this is a legitimate threat, you need to act now. And yet she has denied, she's maintained that, look, I was telling her and she was not acting. This is someone who's the crux, a crucial link in the chain of conveying the information from the people on the front lines to the administration. It's not just a credibility issue. It's not just offered just to impeach her. It does impeach her. It is inconsistent with what she testified to previously. She denied in her testimony. She said that I subjectively thought that this was a toy gun. Yes, but I never told that to Dr. Parker. And here, number one, she does on this video say, she heavily implies, if not expressly says, I told Dr. Parker, quote, he had something in his pocket. I said, keep him in your eye, and I went and told my AP, this and this, and we were just watching him. And if anything, we thought it was just a toy. She's saying in the context of reporting to the assistant principal, she told her that they thought, if anything, was the toy. The jury seeing that evidence can put two and two together, and they can infer, it's a fair inference from that evidence, that what Kovacs was saying to them at the time of the incident was, me and Zwerner, or another third party, were watching JT. I went to report what we saw to Dr. Parker, and I let her know, we thought if anything it was a toy gun. That is significant evidence. That is something the jury should hear. I understand that ordinarily, oftentimes when you impeach with a prior inconsistent statement, it is typically done right there on the stand when you confront that person. But all they need is a fair opportunity for cross-examination. There is nothing here where they have an opportunity to call her as a rebuttal witness, to bring her up on the stand and explain it herself. There's a risk there. She could be subject to cross-examination again, but that's not my problem. And also, the defense has no obligation to disclose the purpose for which it's offering its evidence in advance. We can offer it for multiple purposes. It is relevant. Her state of mind demonstrates that this is the lady who's banging on the door saying, gun, 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 gun. And now she's telling there on the scene, in clear digital evidence that the jury can see, that she's saying otherwise. She's saying, I thought this was a toy gun. She minimizes the threat. If we take that away from the jury, we don't know what the outcome is going to be. This is significant. It would be prejudicial. It would not be harmless error to exclude this.
But can't you call her yourself? She's still a subpoenaed witness in the case. And then I think for impeachment purposes, you'd have to ask her if she said that or not. So I don't think it comes in under impeachment at this time. Did you have state of mind response to that?
Well, what he just said proves why it can't come into evidence.
At this time.
Period. First of all, he's failed to give the opportunity for the witness to explain herself. But what he now wants to use is the jury can infer that this video statement that was done after the fact to the officer must be what she told the defendant, and they should be able to infer that. Let the defendant take the stand and explain what she heard or she didn't heard. You don't get to put on an officer in a videotape when you fail to do it in the proper cross-examination process to allow her to explain herself, and then use we and inferences without the defendant taking the stand and say, this is what Kovac told me or didn't tell me. But now they're trying to infer stuff from a hearsay statement. Can't impeach your own witness. If he puts her on the stand to ask her, he cannot impeach his own witness.
No, I completely agree. I'm not going
to. And so how does he come up now with another officer with a videotape to try to impeach her with extrinsic evidence, which is not allowed under the rule, then try to come up and say, hey, you get up on the stand, I want to impeach you by your prior inconsistent statement, which you can't do. Put the defendant on the stand and ask what was said.
But
that's how you do it.
But doesn't the exception for hearsay, which it is, state of mind, that can be for both witnesses, plaintiffs and defendants, isn't that true?
But it's, I'm trying to keep Mr. Benyazin from knocking me over. But the state of mind here is not the state of mind of the discussion with the defendant when the evidence was coming through as to whether or not there was a gun threat. That's what you said on the stand. And this is 2:18, so we're way past the shooting and way, way past, hours past, when she spoke to the defendant.
All right, so I'm going to sustain the objection on impeachment, but I'm overruling it as to the existing mental, emotional, or physical condition, state of mind, Rule 2-803, subsection 3.
Turner, may I just address that for a moment?
Uh-huh.
The then existing state of mind exception, which is 803.3, applies to the then existing state of mind of the individual making the declarant statement. The issue here is that there is case law that demonstrates that if the declarant is attempting to demonstrate the state of mind of someone who is not the declarant, it is inadmissible for that purpose. This comes up in circumstances where people opine or testify that we had a plan to do XYZ. And that is offered in those contexts to say we had a plan, as in that's our state of mind, to do something in the future. But the issue here is the we, as is reflected in the statement, is an attempt to reflect the state of mind of the other in this context. If it was I, Ms. Kovac, thought it was a toy gun, different. We agree. 803.03 might apply in that context. But they've told the court that the only relevant purpose is not whether Amy Kovac thought it was a toy gun. It's that we can infer from the statement that somebody else thought it was a toy gun because it goes to their state of mind. And that is explicitly impermissible in 803.03.
Well, we can give the jury an explanation if there's no other way that this comes in, that this statement only goes to Ms. Kovac's state of mind.
And in that case, I think the exception might apply, but the question then becomes, if this is only being offered for the state of mind of Ms. Kovac at 2:18 p.m. on January 6th, what is the relevance of her state of mind at 2:18 p.m. on January 6th? If this was a recorded statement of Ms. Kovac, using their words, hindsight 2020, if this was a recorded statement of Ms. Kovac at 1:40, at 1:45, at 1:55, before the shooting took place, and she's expressing her state of mind in those contexts, then her state of mind may be relevant to what ultimately occurs. What we're now talking about is trying to say what her state of mind was at 2:18. Let's then say and infer what it was from that based upon an undisclosed period of time. And then the question is, how is that even relevant if it's at 2:18?
Here's the statement. It's the then existing statement.
As pointed out, the rule by title is then existing, then as in 2:18 p.m. In the evidentiary, look, this is when they make fun of me about my nerdiness of evidence rules. Ultimately, it's all about reliability. And the issue with reliability when we talk about people talking about prior states of mind is that we've lived life for 2 hours. And it is speculative, even Your Honor sustained an objection earlier in this trial when we said, well, you would have done or you could have done different. And that's because we would have or we could have are all questions of speculative time frame, even if it's our own being. And so the then refers to then, 2:18 p.m.
Such as motive, intent, or plan. That's what it's used.
Joseph, I could just respond to a few quick points.
You may.
Just revisiting the relevance issue briefly. I know this is not the crux here, but the fact that opposing counsel is vehemently opposing the introduction of this highly probative evidence demonstrates its relevance. They don't want this to come in because the jury needs to hear about it. Regardless of that, in addition, I think that the jury, when they watch this video, they can assess Ms. Kovach's demeanor, they can see how she's responding to the deputy's inquiries, and they can assess and weigh her credibility just by watching the video and seeing how she reacts and responds. This is the crucial witness that the jury needs to decide her credibility. Yes, prior inconsistent statements is one piece of that, but it's also just watching her demeanor. They talk about that in appellate law all the time. You can't do that just from a cold record. The jury has to do it, and the jury can't do it without watching the video.
But if you're saying it's trying to impeach her, I'm not going to allow you to do it this way. So I'm going to agree with plaintiff's counsel that this her state of mind, I would allow it in as a state of mind, but her state of mind isn't relevant at this time. And so I'm going to grant the objection, sustain the objection.
Well, Judge, I wanted to be clear. I was addressing the impeachment argument, but I will offer it for a dual purpose. That is why I offered it. I had two bases to offer this. One was to impeach and one was to show her state of mind. I agree with the court that it is relevant, especially it's conditionally relevant at a minimum because we'll have an expert to explain this to a jury that Ms. Kovach's subjective state of mind mattered for the expert to assess, for Dr. Parker
but
to assess.
But I haven't heard that testimony yet. I haven't heard your expert yet. So maybe it comes in at that time. It just as the beginning of your case, I'm not going to do that.
Then I would ask the court to reserve ruling on this at this time.
Oh, yeah, at this time. I mean, you have other ways you can try to introduce it. I'm not disagreeing with you that way. It's not forbidden. If there are other ways to introduce it, I'll allow you to do that, or if it becomes relevant.
Thank you, Judge. I appreciate
it. All right, so objections noted with leave to try to get it in later. All right.
Judge, for purposes of expediency, let me just proffer, if I may, the contents of the other video. I think these are similar issues that we would grapple with.
Yes.
Is there any objection?
Decision.
Is there any objection?
I object to everything about this witness and all the videos.
Okay.
I think we should play the tape.
Okay.
Brian, please cue up Defense Exhibit 57A. A8, excuse me.
You did 8.
Oh, pardon, A10.
What we did check his bag, like what we thought, you know? And she didn't say anything back to me, like he moved something back from his pocket. Like, I don't. I mean, again, so that's 6-year-old.
So you can see clearly, Judge, going in reverse order. Again, it's a 6-year-old that goes to the heart of Amy Kovach's state of mind. At the time, shortly after this incident, she's telling law enforcement, someone who has authority, someone who you don't want to mess with, that you want to be candid with, especially when she's taking ownership of investigating this and saying, I was the first one in the room. She's talking to this person. The jury can see this is her live when she's telling people for the first time what happened. And she says, it's a 6-year-old. That's showing her state of mind. And it will be conditionally relevant at a minimum when we put on our expert to explain, yes, the manner, the demeanor of the reporting parties is a factor for the administrator to assess whether, when, and how to respond. Let me just make this concrete. If Kovach comes into the office and says, There's a gun in the building. There's a gun in the building. We saw it. You need to go right now. Get up right now. Get out. Get over there. It's materially different from going into the office and saying, I think it's a toy gun. You know, I think it's a toy gun. You know, he's a six-year-old. Her demeanor is what matters. And that's something that Dr. Parker had to consider. And it is part of the heart of this case. So I think it goes to the...
There's just not enough. You haven't put on enough of a case to make it relevant at this point in time. I'm not denying that at some point it could be relevant. But at this time, it's an improper impeachment, and at this time, it's not relevant. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
I don't, but okay. There's someone at my table who might.
Your Honor, I think it is flawed from the outset. And the reason it's flawed is the argument now that the demeanor of the witness is pertinent to the jury because it goes to the administrator's state of mind of how they subjectively interpreted the demeanor of that individual when they made the report. How are we to say that her demeanor at 2:20 p.m. is the demeanor at 11:40 p.m. or 11:50 p.m.? And so, in fact, it is the opposite is true, which is that if Your Honor permitted this for that purpose, which is to demonstrate the demeanor of a witness, so that defense counsel can argue that that demeanor reflected the demeanor at the time that the reports were made, that is flawed, ab initio.
They may be able to put on a case where it does either become relevant or impeachment, and we'll take those up separately if we ever get there. So I'm going to grant the motion on those grounds at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Any other questions for the corporal at this time?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Okay, and obviously he's to remain under subpoena, correct?
Yes, but I'll be in contact with you. Appreciate
okay. All right, so obviously the jury's not here, so that's why we did this. So I'm not permitting your testimony on those grounds right now. However, I do. You are still under subpoena and subject to recall, so please don't discuss your testimony. And until then, or someone tells you that you're released, you can't talk about it, okay?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for being here again.
Bye.
All right. Do you have any other evidence you can present this afternoon?
This was our sole witness. We did our best to try to recruit some others, but we've also consolidated our case. I will confer with the lead counsel on this and we'll make a decision.
All right. So you want me to release the jury and then you talk and then I'll come back out, or we're just ending for the day once?
Well, you had indicated earlier this morning that the 7 o'clock, I read your comments to suggest that the 7 o'clock rule of exchanging witnesses wouldn't apply since we came to court today having advised them on Monday that we'd be finished Wednesday afternoon or Thursday morning with only one witness. So we don't want to wait and find out what we're doing tomorrow until 7, since we waited last night to find out there was one witness who wasn't even going to get on the stand. So we'd like to know if there's a time that we could get it by 4, or wait right here and do it and say, tell us who your witnesses are tomorrow.
All right, so you're asking for some more time, is that correct?
Just to confer with counsel. Like,
okay. And as I said, I can bring the jury and release them, then step out, and then I can come back. I'm fine with that. Me getting up and down isn't a problem. It's them.
Yeah, I would let them come and go.
Right.
My only concern with that, just to fight it, is if they're released and they have no evidence tomorrow, and they're being asked to come back,
right,
and then we just release them again tomorrow.
Right.
That would be my only hesitation. Right. That's your honor's. This is your courtroom. This is how you handle it. But if their position after conferral in 20 minutes is we don't have any fact witnesses and we have no evidence, I mean, we take issue with that administratively.
Right. I understand.
But we understand that the experts were scheduled for Monday. I wouldn't want the jury to come back tomorrow morning and,
for nothing.
Yeah, right. Let them wear their costumes and be with their family if that's what's going to happen.
All right. I understand. All right. I appreciate that approach then. How long are you going to need to discuss strategy, I guess, or figuring out if we can call witnesses tomorrow?
And I want to say, I am sympathetic to you having set up your experts on Monday.
I have no problem. We've discussed that the whole time getting ready. But I would like to do something, if we can do anything, tomorrow, and whether or not we need the jury. I certainly, if we don't do anything tomorrow, I want jury instructions worked on.
Yes,
that would be, okay.
I think we can have about 15, 20 minutes.
All right, I'll grant you that. And then I'll just go address the jury that they're not going to be needed for the rest of the day. We're determining the schedule from this day forward, and we ask them to be patient with us.
Yes,
okay. All right. Court will be in recess for hopefully 15 minutes.
Right,
thank you.
No additional witnesses today from the defense, but I would propose We reserve tomorrow. We release the jury tomorrow. We can handle jury instructions. Come back Monday and address experts. But I also ask, given the court's ruling, leave to potentially call Deputy Blythe to establish the requisite foundation necessary to get that evidence in.
Okay. All right. Did you want to work at your offices or on the jury instructions or here?
Good question. Okay.
I try to ask good questions, I promise.
That's a great question, honestly. I'd be comfortable doing it by remote with the court and with counsel. The thing that I will sort of flag is that there are going to be issues as it relates to the substance of the experts, obviously, which were motions in limine. So we may, if we have time, do that tomorrow, and to the extent maybe they're available. I haven't talked to them about this, so I don't want to put them under the gun. To the extent they're able to appear via Zoom so that we can have that proffer, that may be helpful too.
Okay.
Other than that, we would take issue with fact witnesses being called Monday in light of the delay, and we would ask that anyone that is under subpoena that is not being called be allowed to be released. There are folks that wish to be in the courtroom to observe some of these proceedings, and they haven't been able to do so because they're still under subpoena and haven't been notified that they're going to be called.
Your Honor, I don't know if my experts are available tomorrow for a proffer. My understanding is the issue with Dr. Klinger, who matches Dr. Schuffelbarger, is we've worked that out. I can't represent to the court that there's only one other expert at issue, and that's Dr. Means, and I can't represent that he's available tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to make for a frustrating Monday, but I understand.
Yes.
We could, and I'll alert the court that their forensic psychologist, I think, is something that we could take up without a proffer. We don't think that the witness should be permitted to testify in toto, but we don't have to take that up today.
Right. Yes, yeah. I think it's going to be a Monday problem, you know, the way that we had planned this. And as I said, we did the best planning we could. So
yeah, I'm not aware of any motion regarding Dr. Hagen, the forensic psychologist.
It wasn't challenged. So it was not challenged in the motions in the review.
It is being challenged.
Nope. All right, well, I guess we'll just have to take that up when we can on Monday, I think. I don't know how else to do that. All right, so I can be available by Zoom, obviously, or WebEx tomorrow, up to a certain time, seeing as it's Halloween, and to take care of any disputes. But I would appreciate a set of agreed-upon instructions, one set of plaintiffs offered and objected to, and defense offered and objected to. For at least I can get myself and my law clerks who have abandoned me Oh, there you are. To start looking this weekend at some of those issues. So
yes,
I would appreciate that.
We need to rest in front of the jury.
Okay. Yeah, because we got to bring them in and talk to them anyways. All right, so agreement that we'll all be available by WebEx tomorrow. I'm going to release the jury for today and tomorrow to report Monday at 9 a.m. And jury instructions, hopefully the three sets of instructions by one. Is that possibility? All right, is that agreeable? All right, very well. Thank you. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a motion that's going to be made by the plaintiff in your presence, and then I'm going to address you.
Your Honor, plaintiff at this time rests their case.
All right. The plaintiff's evidence has now concluded, so we are going to move on to the defendant's case, but we are not going to do that until Monday morning at 9 a.m. So you are done for the day. You are also done for Friday. You can get caught up with your families and or work, whichever order you want to put those in. I leave that up to you. And also enjoy Halloween as well. So as always, and it is very important because I'm not going to see you for 3 days. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we are now recessing for our break until Monday at 9 a.m. when I ask you to be back in the main courthouse to check in. During this recess of this trial, you are not to begin the discussion of any aspect of this case. Upon your return, you are requested to go immediately to the main courthouse, and then you will be brought down here. You are not to engage in any conversation with any of the parties, the witnesses, the attorneys, or any of the spectators, including the media. You are not to go to the scene of this case or undertake any independent investigation, including the internet or other electronic means. No one should approach you and discuss this matter, and you should not remain within hearing distance of anyone discussing any aspect of this case. That includes your family members and loved ones, and tell them you are, by order of this court, not allowed to discuss or be within hearing of any discussion of this case. Of course, as I've indicated, this includes viewing any newspapers or television or listening to the radio. Watch a lot of sports or scary movies. Those are your two choices. You must also leave your notepads and any notes that you have taken with my deputy. He will make sure no one looks at them and they remain solely in our custody. If you are approached by anyone concerning your jury service during this trial or this recess, make that fact known to my sheriff or me. We will take it up at Monday at 9 a.m. Thank you for your patience with us. You are excused. Then any witnesses you are able to release, I would appreciate you doing so that they can either come back or be released from their witness list. And anything else to take up?
We okay to leave technology and stuff all hooked up as it is.
Yep. No problem at all. Anything else from the defense? All right. I will hear from you tomorrow. Thank you all very much. Court is in recess.
More continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial is coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment. From the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.
Ah, greetings from my bath, festive friends. The holidays are overwhelming, but I'm tackling this season with PayPal and making the most of my money. Getting 5% cash back when I pay in four. No fees, no interest. I used it to get this portable spa with jets. Now the bubbles can cling to my sculpted but pruny body. Make the most of your money this holiday with PayPal. Save the offer in the app.
Ends 12/31. See paypal.com/promo terms. Points can be redeemed for cash and more. Pay in four subject to terms and approval. PayPal Inc. and MLS 910457.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. Anabe sofas combine ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. Anabe has designed the only fully machine washable sofa from top to bottom. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Sofas start at just $699. And right now, get early access to Black Friday savings, up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are all the people I love so hard to shop for?
Like me?
Exactly.
Honey, I'm easy. But you're right. Holiday gifting is stressful.
And all the gift guides out there are boring and uninspired.
Wait, what about the guide we made?
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts mean incredible value?
It's Giving Gifts! A series of guides filled with premium gifts at great value for everyone on your list.
Yeah, because if I see one more for the dad who likes golf list, I'm out.
Right? How about something for the people who actually surprise you?
With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto. Psst, she wants a pair of stilettos.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Dying to see what those are.
And you won't believe their prices.
Just wait till you see what else is in there. It's basically a one-stop shop for everyone you know.
I started bookmarking half the list for myself, honestly.
This is the guy for the 2025 holiday gifting season.
Check out the guide on marshalls.com.
It's giving gifts! Gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
In today's digital economy, enterprise leaders are seeing firsthand how AI is transforming advertising. Amazon Ads demonstrates this every day. AWS AI processes billions of advertising decisions in real time, driving campaign optimization on a truly global scale. So what does this mean for enterprise operations? AWS AI enables precise targeting and dynamic optimization across your entire advertising ecosystem. Amazon has proven this through its own digital transformation, deploying enterprise-grade AI solutions that compress multi-week workflows into hours while maintaining precision at global scale. AWS AI's machine learning capabilities integrate seamlessly with existing advertising workflows, all while maintaining enterprise-grade security and compliance. And because it scales effortlessly, it can support organizations operating in 10 markets or 100. Transform your advertising operations with the same AI technology that powers Amazon's global success. AWS AI, where advertising meets intelligence. See the Amazon ad story at aws.com/ai/our-story.
Ah, greetings from my bath, festive friends. The holidays are overwhelming, but I'm tackling this season with PayPal and making the most of my money, getting 5% cash back when I pay in four. No fees, no interest. I used it to get this portable spa with jets. Now the bubbles can cling to my sculpted but pruny body. Make the most of your money this holiday with PayPal. Save the offer in the app.
Ends 12/31. See paypal.com/promo. Terms. Points can be redeemed for cash and more. Pay in four subject to terms and approval. PayPal Inc. and MLS 910457.
What does Zyn really give you? Not just hands-free nicotine satisfaction, but also real freedom. Freedom to do more of what you love, when and where you want to do it. When is the right time for Zyn? It's any time you need to be ready for every chance that's coming your way. Smoke-free, hassle-free, on your terms. Why bring Zyn along for the ride? Because America's number one nicotine pouch opens up something just as exciting as the road ahead. It opens up the endless possibilities of now. From the way you spend your day, to the people you choose to spend it with. From the to-do list right in front of you, to the distant goal only you can see. With Zyn, you don't just find freedom, you keep finding it, again and again. Find your Zyn. Learn more at Zyn.com. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. Anabe sofas combine ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. Anabe has designed the only fully machine washable sofa from top to bottom. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Sofas start at just $699. And right now, get early access to Black Friday savings, up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Greetings from my bath, festive friends. The holidays are overwhelming, but I'm tackling this season with PayPal and making the most of my money, getting 5% cash back when I pay in four. No fees, no interest. I used it to get this portable spa with jets. Now the bubbles can cling to my sculpted but pruny body. Make the most of your money this holiday with PayPal. Save the offer in the app.
Ends 12/31. See paypal.com/promo. Terms. Points can be redeemed for cash and more. Pay in four subject to terms and approval. PayPal Inc. and MLS 910457.
Life gets messy. Spills, stains, and kid chaos. But with Anabe, cleaning up is easy. Our sofas are fully machine washable, inside and out, so you never have to stress about messes again. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Get early access to Black Friday pricing right now. Sofas start at just $699. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
She's been thinking about this sleepover all week, but I think about her food allergies all the time. Fortunately, her doctor prescribes Xolair, omalizumab. It's proven to significantly reduce allergic reactions if a food allergy accident happens.
Xolair 150 milligrams is a prescription medication used to treat food allergy in people 1 year of age and older to reduce allergic reactions due to accidental exposure to one or more foods. While taking Xolair, you should continue to avoid all foods to which you are allergic. Don't use if you are allergic to Xolair. Xolair may cause a severe, life-threatening allergic reaction called anaphylaxis. Tell your doctor if you ever had anaphylaxis. Get help right away if you have trouble breathing or if you have swelling of your throat or tongue. Xolair should not be used for the emergency treatment of allergic reactions, including anaphylaxis. Xolair is for maintenance use to reduce allergic reactions, including anaphylaxis, while avoiding food allergens. Serious side effects such as cancer, fever, muscle aches and rash, parasitic infection, or heart and circulation problems have been reported. Please see Xolair.com for full prescribing information. Ask an allergist about Xolair. This is an advertisement for Xolair paid for by Genentech and Novartis.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
Love the night? Reach for Zin After Dark, a limited cocktail-inspired series for those who get up when the sun goes down. Try Zin's Mojito, Spiced Cider, and Espresso Martini nicotine pouches. Find them at select retailers, available while supplies last. Zin After Dark. Bring on the night. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.